Magic Without Fears, Hermetic Podcast. I'm your host, Frater RC. For more and exclusive episodes, visit magicwithoutfears.com. Thank you for your support. Magic Without Fears, Hermetic Podcast. I'm your host, Frater RC. For more and exclusive episodes, visit magicwithoutfears.com. Thank you for your support.
I'm going to hit roll on this. Why not? Here we are. So this Shakespeare documentary had, you know, them looking out the letters and reversing letters to create Masonic symbols and stuff. It was Jesse Frater C that turned me on to it last night, and I checked it out. I was like, oh, I'm not gonna sleep. But I did sleep, but then was like, well, I'm gonna treat myself today to a 3-hour documentary on Shakespeare, because who doesn't? Like, obviously we all love that period and Roger Bacon and all that Rosicrucian Freemasonic early days is fascinating, but we also just love Shakespeare, right? We just love Shakespeare.
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah. Like, I've got way too much Shakespeare rolling around in my head already.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Have you ever done any in like any sort of form?
In college, I went to college at Southern Oregon University, and that place is,
I hear Oregon has a Shakespeare festival.
Yeah. It's in the same town.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I went to it in grade eight.
Oh yeah.
Grade
we went like every year growing up. So yeah, I've been to a lot of Shakespeare, and when I was going to college there, they had a really good Shakespeare class. And so like I've done parts of Macbeth and parts of Hamlet and parts of, I want to say like Twelfth Night. Which one has the bear? Is that Twelfth Night?
Which one has the bear? Oh yeah.
there's a few of them that I get mixed up, you know. There's like the one that has the bear, and then there's the one that has the twins.
That one which the witches that no one likes.
Well, that's Macbeth. Everybody likes the witches.
I know, I'm joking. That's like the one everyone likes. Actually, I have a little story about that. So in grade eight, that was every grade year in Waldorf School, a grade eight class does a Shakespeare play every year. Full play too. They do the whole thing. And there was only three guys in our class, or two guys really, because one was Japanese and was sort of checking out. He had discovered booze, so he was sort of checking out. We wrote down our top three choices for what we wanted to be, and I wrote down witch number one, witch number two, witch number three. I thought that was very clever. I'm like, that way they have to make me a witch, because my top three choices are the top three witches. And the teacher, to my surprise, was like, no, you can't be a witch at all. Because there's no men have ever been witches, and a man can't be a witch under any circumstances.
But
that's what she said in 1994.
Well, but that's like wrong on multiple levels. Like, first of all,
here's the kicker. So you know what she cast me as? No, here's the kicker, bro. So she therefore she cast me as Hecate.
Like
the goddess of the witches.
Is Hecate even in Macbeth?
Yeah, Hecate shows up and addresses the witches.
Oh man!
And it was a beautiful thing, and I nailed it with my like waist length black hair and robe that I already had, and I did, of course. Like, and I invoked Hecate, and but of course the irony is like you can't be one of the witches because you're a guy, but you're the goddess of magic.
Yeah, it's just like
I couldn't get my teacher to see the irony of it at all. And she was just like obtuse to it. And she was a great teacher otherwise, but like it's funny how even the people we rely on to teach us things can still be critically flawed in their critical capacities.
I kind of suspect every human on the planet has some critical flaw.
Well, yes, I hope so. We're not all sinners.
I hope so too,
but otherwise... that let it not be one so ironically silly. Let men be witches. Let men be witches.
I mean, men were
and goddesses. We're right.
Yeah, I mean, but not only that, Shakespeare didn't even use male actor or female actors. So all of those witches would have been played by men anyhow.
Great point. I'm sure I will let Mrs. Wilby know your additional point when I, if I encounter her again.
If Mrs. Wilby is listening to this.
Well, she was pretty cool. Like when I turned in my grade 8 book report or biography, you have to write a biography for English in grade 8. I did it on Aleister Crowley, trying to shock her and everyone else in the lower school. And she just saw, I was like, oh, Aleister Crowley, how delightful. You know, I was like, what? You're meant to be shocked. Shocked. And she was just like, oh, well, he had lots to do with Steiner and all that whole bunch. I can tell you all about it over lunch. And I was like, Jesus. That was when I started to really realize there was more to Waldorf school than I realized.
Oh, you got to go to Oh, that's right. Yeah, we talked
about K through before. 12. Yeah.
That's pretty exciting.
For those who don't know, we did do a podcast when I was up at Chris Bennett's place. We did a lovely 2-hour conversation. I was new to Zoom, but also it did record, just only recorded 17 minutes. And I don't know why. Right now we had some trouble connecting with I had to restart the computer and all these things. I think Zoom doesn't like it when you're late, but it also doesn't like it when you have too much magical power between the two talkers, right? It's just too much.
We're incompatible with technology. It's...
I mean, that whole thing on Oak Island in the Shakespeare documentary, to bring it back to the main topic clearly we plan to talk about, which is Shakespeare treasures.
Shakespeare treasures. 3 hours of Shakespeare treasures.
One of the things when they're going to the part of the island that corresponds, according to this theory, with Hesed, Mercy, in the swamp, they had to drain the swamp. But like every time they went out there, all their electrical devices were short-circuiting and not working and stuff like that. So that's interesting. I mean, I guess the Ark of the Covenant is just too powerful.
Or it's just British engineering.
Well, I mean, it is a swamp, and you know, there could be lots of reasons, I guess, why technology would not work. Yeah,
it's true. Yeah, I guess I don't know a whole lot about the Oak Island legend. I've read about it a couple times, but I've never gotten into the TV show or watched documentaries or any of that kind of stuff. So I'm not really sure, like, what's the big deal with it? Like, there's treasure?
Oh, well, so it's supposed to have not only the Templar treasures like the Grail and the Ark of the Covenant, but also all of Shakespeare's original manuscripts coated in mercury. And that's what this documentary shows you. If you slip paper into Quicksilver, apparently it actually coats the page and effectively preserves it for basically forever. And I didn't realize that. And this is actually, that was actually one of the coolest things, because I'm sure they wouldn't be saying it in on a actual show if it wasn't vetted by a scientist. Like, yeah, they show you them dipping a page in mercury. Like, that would be a great way to preserve our diaries. Of course, it would also make them dangerous to read in the future or keep around you.
Yeah. And is it specifically like the type of paper that Shakespeare would have been using? Because he would have been using,
I don't know if it would work on regular duotang paper, but you can try if you got a bunch of mercury.
Well, I'll just start collecting. I'm going to start hitting the thrift stores and getting some thermometers. And
Yeah.
How do you get the paper out of the mercury later?
Well, they just showed you dipping it. I don't know, man. There's a whole process. You can probably check it out. I'm sure this documentary came out a while back, and I'm glad that Fred C told me to watch it. It was really, really, sinfully pleasurable to see all the decoding of the writings and using, stenographia and looking like there's like, but this is not a complete Hebrew word for the tabernacle, which would be, Aron Habrit. There's no yod there, but then they're like, what about that like apostrophe on the line above? That could be it. And then Tobias Churton chimes in, because he's there, of course. And he's like, and there at the beginning of the sentence, you see IVD at the beginning of that word. So that's a yod that's sort of suggesting that. They're like, oh, crazy. It's like, yeah, it's you know how this sort of stuff is. It's so fun once you actually do get into it. But if it doesn't lead you to anything, chances are it's because there's nothing there to be led to. But there probably actually is a treasure buried at Oak Island. Like, people did bury treasures. The Templars probably did go bury treasure there. And like, like the pit that they've been digging at, the money pit, as they call it, like it is booby trapped and people die. They've died many times throughout the 100+ years it's been excavated. So
how deep is the pit?
That's what they're trying to find out, right? And they've like scuba dived under the water. It is a remarkable place. It's well, if anyone does want to spend a couple hundred hours like absorbing a fun adventure, it is a fun adventure, and it'll probably go on for quite some time.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the old world, at least in Europe, there's tons of, you know, treasure buried all over the place, which is probably one of the reasons why treasure discovery is such a popular topic in grimoires, right? I mean, I know people have been talking about that a lot.
That's a really good point. Here,
yeah, I mean, because they didn't have banks. So where are you going to put your treasure? You're just going to bury a hole in the backyard?
Yeah.
Deposit it with the gnomes.
Amen.
Yeah. But, you know, like out here, we don't really have a history of people like hoarding gold and treasure as much. So.
No, just Ron Swanson from Parks and Recreation, right?
Yeah. 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 You hear stories every once in a while of like some crazy person who's like burying all their silver on their property or something. Okay, maybe crazy is a strong word. Some overly cautious individual who has converted their wealth to precious metals and is burying it on their property. But we need, you know, we need like the millennia of buildup where there's a lot of these individuals doing it all over the place in order to get kind of like the density of treasure buried in the ground.
Yeah. You know, it is though, what you mentioning the magical seeking of these things, it's, we do find amazing things that are hidden, such as like the lost D papers that were discovered in a secret contraptment in a trunk, right? That was relatively recent. So like I believe the original Golden Dawn people didn't have those. They were found after, if I'm not mistaken. I can't recall exactly because
I can't remember either. Well, we have, so you're talking about the stuff that was post Casaubon.
Yeah, yes, the Heptarchia Mystica, I believe it was, that was discovered in a false bottom of a trunk that was sold at auction, and this guy found it.
Well, that's pretty badass.
That's badass. Badass. We got to work with that material. I was trained on it in the Golden Dawn. We worked through it. Like, it's great material. Awesome. It's very great material. What else do we have?
Yeah, but we also have like all of those grimoire scholars who are going through all of the old cataloged stuff and, you know, the piles and piles of manuscripts that we've got in all of the libraries in Europe, and they're constantly coming up with cool things.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, like Dr. Saif, who's coming out with the new translation of the Picatrix out of Arabic.
Mm, exciting.
It's pretty exciting. But the last interview I heard with her, she was talking about how like, oh, I was done, but then I discovered another Picatrix manuscript that had been lost. And so I had to redo my critical edition and start over. I'm like, oh shit. So yeah, it's ongoing. You know, all of these magical texts were just sort of relegated to the dustbins of history, and they've been miscategorized and miscatalogued and sometimes just kind of like forgotten in dusty corners.
Yeah. Something I just took copious notes through 3.5 hours of Dr. Attrell and Dr. Sludge going over Kabbalah and Platonism. And Sludge made a point, which have been academics, we try to make this point to people all the time to encourage them to spend all their money or bankrupt themselves going to university, the majority of Kabbalistic manuscripts are still untranslated. It's the same for Aramaic spells that I used to look at in the second century, like the stuff I was looking at, no one's ever translated a lot of it. And there's tons of it, and there's more of the Kabbalistic stuff untranslated. And as Dr. Justin Sledge pointed out, actually, in fact, the majority of it's never even been transcribed yet, let alone translated and then released. Which is still a very lush field for people to do academic and scholarly work in, is go learn these languages. A lot of them aren't that hard. Some of them are, Arabic's tricky. Hebrew and Aramaic are simple languages. Latin's pretty easy. Greek is hard. But like, yeah. Go do it. Just like, you know, bit by bit, like there's good books that people like us can recommend, and you can go do it and then translate new documents, or just even go to the libraries and just retranscribe ones. I think that's how Tarl Warwick did it with someone, and a bunch of people are doing that. I think Stephen Skinner does that. He has a guy in London. He'll go and transcribe the document, send it to Skinner. Skinner will put out his corrected one based on his knowledge, and the other one, the original transcription. $80 a pop.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I tried doing that with a manuscript, a Hebrew astrological manuscript that I found in a French library that had been scanning all of their stuff online. And I was like, oh, this looks so cool. Like here,
you know, cool.
Glyphs, I can get some of these words out, but the, whoever wrote that damn thing, their handwriting was so bad that, yeah. I could not decipher it. I couldn't transcribe it. I could get like one word out of 20 probably. It wasn't enough for me. But again, I'm no expert in crappy medieval Hebrew handwriting.
Yes, sure it's a thing. Yeah. It's a thing. When I was beginning my Evelyn Underhill research for my dissertation with Nicholas Goodrich Clark, my first step was to work with some other professors in the Belfast public archives on Victorian, well, 1700 to early 20th century publican ledgers. And he was a blind professor who needed someone to read that, who had a background in these things. And so I was learning a lot from him, because I would even sometimes describe a word I couldn't make out, or an abbreviation I wasn't familiar with, and he would tell me what it was. And that was all preparatory to me then planning to go to Cambridge and go through Underhills and related stuff. Of course, Nicholas died, and so that all ended, but the skill set in reading old writing in each language is remarkably important. And with some, it's very hard. Like German's very hard. Like I'm going to stick, when it comes to old handwriting and old orthography, I'm going to stick with English and maybe Hebrew Aramaic, because you can only master so many of those.
Yeah, it's true. I was actually just talking to somebody who was complaining about reading, like old German black letter.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know. I mean, black letter just takes some getting used to. I'm cool with it.
That form. Again, but when then you go to handwritten variety of, you know, that, then it's a whole other beast, yeah. Right? With their abbreviations. Yeah. And then just the older German grammatical style language, like fluent speakers, regular people will tell you they can't understand old high German. Or middle high.
Yeah, they can't. It's weird. I've tried that, and I can't get it either. Yeah, it's.
If we think English gets crazy with reading critical theory stuff, in Germany, it's not expected that a native fluent speaker will even be able to read any academic writing. Like that's just their basic. The basic kind of academic style is just too advanced in simple German for the average citizen to read. And that's something we don't really have here in the West, of course, in English. If you're writing something that a native English speaker can't read at all, then you're probably doing it wrong. you're certainly not being serviceable, but in German academia, it's almost expected that you need to know the critical style. Anyway, but so for people who don't know much about you, you are Arnomancy, the great and wise, famous Arnomancy. Shouting out at
I go into by the neurosphere,
Eric, Reverend Eric, shouting out Reverend into the neurosphere from Portland, Oregon, which has been a very peaceful city for the past year.
we don't even need to get into that anymore. It was kind of blown out of. It was actually really, really blown out of proportion. A lot of the protests and stuff was happening in a very small part of the city. It wasn't really that bad.
I have a lot of friends there, so that's what they all said. And even my friends in Seattle said the same thing. So it's like the media's gone crazy. Media's lost its mind. That's why it is the age of the podcast. The age.
I feel like a lot of podcasts have kind of lost their mind too. Feels like just then, people have lost their minds lately. It's an age of madness is what it is.
Yes. Well, thank God there's a cultist to make it all make sense. You know,
we all make sense.
You know you're in a strange time when a cultist start to make more sense than other things.
Yeah, I think everybody should probably, like, you know, wake up and pay attention to the fact that people like us are making sense, and then be like, oh crap, we let the real world go too far.
Yeah.
Kind of rein it in, folks.
When we're more logical than mass media.
Yeah.
When gematria makes more sense than the headlines.
Yeah, I mean, I think the last time that this happened was probably like right before the 30 Years War, and we don't want to do that again.
Hey, that's what gave birth to Rosicrucianism in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Rosicrucianism, the third of those was published, 1 year before the 30 Years War started. But the 30 Years War was just like, it was as messy or messier than World War One, like in terms of like, why the heck are we fighting a war?
Yeah, folks, if we could like keep the insanity going on now to less than 30 years, that would just be swell.
Yeah.
I'm already really bored like of it. That. I'm already
Me
bored
too.
Of it.
And yeah. I don't want to see like rampaging armies like pillaging villages and stuff. That's not cool. It's the opposite of cool.
I mean, that's why we have Apocalypse Now and Full Metal Jacket and Platoon. It's so that we can see it, engage with it, and then it ends. We get back to our lives.
And we can have that feeling where like, oh yeah, we don't want to do this.
Yeah. It's fun for 2 to 3 hours on the screen. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm in Portland, and you know, I think today hopefully was sort of the turning point of the United States kind of starting to calm down a little bit. I know that you're up in Canada. I want to apologize for us being such a shitty neighbor recently. We'll try to be better.
I actually had just got off the phone right when you called. I just got through to the USPS Postal Service. Is that what you guys call it? Your America. So I got
we just
through.
Call it the US yeah. the USPS, yeah.
Yeah. So they finally got through to me, and I got to talk to a person with the United States Postal Service because Allison Chikosky had shipped a thing for my mom. Mm-hmm. But the address the apartment number got put is the unit number, and so it's not going to get here. So I was on hold with them for 3.5 hours, and we figured out that I have to stop it once it gets to Canada. But I got to talk to the U.S. Postal Service, and she was so frazzled. She sounded so downtrodden. This poor woman working at USPS, she was like, she answered the phone like she was partway turning into a robot, and like her soul was dying. So I was like, I put out as much effort as I could, and then you messaged you were going to be a few minutes late. I was like, perfect, because this woman needs my love. And by the end of it, I had her laughing and giggling. I maybe inserted a few little humanitarian political points. Like I did mention how much money our government's giving everyone, like $2,000 a month, I mean, to most people who need it. Whereas like mm-hmm. y'all are getting next to nothing, well, effectively nothing. Yeah. And I was, she was like, what, really? Tell me that. Tell me more about us. And she like talked to me for 15 minutes. And I was like, you guys, like politics aside, like you guys got to demand money, like actual money, because people are losing their jobs and houses. And that's insane. Like it's not a political issue. It's a humanitarian issue. And your whole country, in my opinion, could unite and be like, yo, where's my money? Give me some money.
I wish we could somehow get through to people that regardless of politics, we have to have a baseline of like compassion and humanitarianism. Like, I feel like that shouldn't be partisan at all, but it
is. Right? That's the crazy thing that you guys got to somehow get past that or something, because like, you can't tell people they can't work and give them no money and then evict them. That's a trifecta of insanity. That it could lead to like that will lead to violence. It already has. It already is. It's going on.
Yeah, it's and we're not done. We're not done.
No, it's just that
to ourselves.
Yeah, you know, you need to be more like Canada in that one way, in which you just give people enough to pay their rent and sit in their apartment stoned all day. Violence gone.
You know, I have a couple of weird anecdotes about that. Like I was joking with another Canadian friend of mine recently, and.
I thought I was your only Canadian friend.
No, I've got 5 of them.
You number us, hey? Am I number 5?
Yeah, you're number 4.
Oh, how elemental.
Yeah. But I was joking about how, you know, as a Freemason, I have a lot, you know, Freemasons sort of like are all across the political spectrum, you know, so yeah. I have a lot of friends
Well, magicians are too, in general.
Magicians are too. Yeah. 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 Like,
radically so.
Yeah. Although the thing with Freemasons is you don't really talk about it very much. Right.
And so it would be nice if magicians didn't either.
God. Yeah. Although magicians, why are, yeah, they're just so many. Okay. Now, anyhow, let me get into this story. So, you know, when our previous president got kicked off of Twitter and kicked off of all these social media platforms, all of his like diehard followers like flocked to things like Telegram and Signal and all of these other platforms, some of which are like encrypted and safe, some of which just like promised to be completely deregulated, et cetera, et cetera. So the thing that has been super strange to me is, you know, because I mean I'm a information security guy, so I've been using encrypted.
Really?
Yeah. So I've been using encrypted platforms for a really, really long time. Like I've been trying to get my friends to move to stuff like Signal and Telegram for years and years and years and years. And it is just, it's like pulling teeth. Except now. Like now
everyone gets it.
But it's all like these old guys that I'm like, oh, I always suspected that you were some sort of like super freaky conservative. You know, because I have a lot of older friends who are Masons and they're all on Telegram now. And they're all on Signal.
Yeah.
And I was just sort of lamenting about how like I can't talk to people in the United States about moving to Signal or Telegram right now because it is such a like far right.
It sounds like a far right dog whistle.
Yeah. And so my Canadian friend is like, you guys will just like politicize everything, won't you? I'm like, yeah. Kind of an American. That's an American thing. And he's like, "What do you even politicize toilet paper?" And I stopped, and I remembered earlier this year. I was like, "Yeah,
we do that too." You did. But you know, here's how I deal with it, brother. I keep in mind that it's not y'all Americans doing this. What it's really the media, through the CIA's Project Mockingbird, and psychic control from their psychic spies that they still have underground at some area. Do you like how I just dragged you down?
Oh God,
I just dragged you down. Yeah, I know, right? Exactly. No, you're on the goofball Canadian podcast that is all about like, yeah, I mean, I said this last time actually for the first time. It's like, honestly, if this could somehow morph into like the one occultist comedy podcast, I would be so fine with that. Like
I would just come around here all the time. I know so many bad jokes.
Oh, hit me up. Did you hear some of the crazy ones on the previous episode with Paul? Oh my God. Like he was like, absolutely. I can't remember them. I'm so bad at remembering dad style jokes, but okay. Give me one.
Now that I'm on the spot, they're all gone. All right. But you know, I do enjoy sarcasm and stupid jokes. So I will make sure that if I think of anything while we're talking, I will interrupt you with sarcastic jokes.
All right. Okay. I'm a little more facetious myself, but that's okay. We balance each other out.
We don't have a difference between facetiousism and sarcasm.
Oh, well, here. We can tell the difference between
fascism and sarcasm, but not
fascism. You can't do fascism? It sounds like something else, so why not? Canadian explain. How would you do it?
Okay.
I'll Canucksplain it to you. This is from a play that I love. Sarcasm is mean. Facetiousness is fascism. Facetious is flip. Is flip. Okay. Sarcasm is mean.
Then you know what? I would like to not be sarcastic. I guess I would rather be facetious.
Yeah. Like, and this is proper definition we're talking. I'm not talking out of my ass.
I'm gonna strive to be facetious rather than sarcastic. It's like sarcastic would be a vice and a virtue.
Yeah. So if you know, we're on video here as well for my special people to whoever see this early or late. But like, you know, yeah, sarcasm would be like, oh, I love your mustache. That's a little mean. That's sarcasm though. I love your mustache. Because clearly I'm not saying I love it. But if I'm facetious, I'm like, oh, it would be more like, oh, I love your mustache. Right? Wait. So it's like, I'm still joking and you don't know if I actually love it, but I'm not being mean. There's no meanness in how I just said that. It's just flip. Right.
And
it's just
if you're,
silly.
If you're facetious, I can just, in my head, I'm going to be like, well, I'm just going to assume he loves my mustache because
yeah, sure.
Of course he does.
The best thing to do is always when someone's sarcastic or facetious is to take them literally.
Yeah.
It amplifies the humor. Right? Like yeah. I used to have a comeback I developed when I was young and still went to clubs and dated and all that stuff. You know, the things you give up as you're about to approach 40. Mm-hmm. 10 days or so.
About to approach 40.
I'm turning 40 in like 10 days. I know I'm
are you kidding?
I'm near to death.
I mean you're still a baby.
Okay.
You're just young. Spring chicken.
Well, no, what was the thing I would say? I would take people literally. I can't remember. If I remember, I'll let you know. Okay. Yeah. But yeah, take people literally if they're mocking you. It's always the best.
I'm going to. Do you remember some of the things that we talked about the first time we recorded? Like what, because I know we had a really good conversation and afterwards I was kind of like, oh, dang.
Yeah. Well, no, so, it, such a shame. Thank you. I just looked up and I'm so glad we're actually recording. Okay. Yeah. It's recording.
Yeah. I see the little light going.
So. It was good. Cause we got to know each other last time and that was awesome because mm-hmm. I didn't know much about you. I really loved what I saw of your work online. And oh, I joined your Patreon live on the recording and you thought that was funny. And I was like,
oh yeah, so. That's right. That's yeah. right.
You told me about your Thank Patreon. You. I didn't realize how many occultists had Patreons and I went to your Patreon, like just followed it right then. And I was like, I'm on your Patreon.
Oh, yeah.
So folks join Arnamancy's Patreon. It's at
yeah, it's at patreon.com/arnamancy.
Yep.
Easy to find.
Yeah. So there you go. And you do a lot of from what I can tell, let's talk about it now that we're there. Okay. You do a lot of sigil work.
Yeah, I guess I did an introduction to sigils class. I guess in 2019, and I did it live at this local occult shop. And it wasn't something that I was planning on doing. Like, I guess I don't really consider myself some sort of like sigil based wizard, although pretty much every magician is incredibly sigil based. We just associate them so much with chaos magic these days that a lot of us don't really think about, like, you know, Solomon's seals are sigils, you know, the Zoso banner behind you, those are all sigils. Like sigils do have like a really broad meaning.
Do you dig it?
I love it. I've been using this as
a traveling altar cloth for myself since I bought it in Galway, Ireland, 2005.
If you ever find yourself back there, pick one up for me.
I think there's this new way to get things called the internet. You should try it.
We don't get that in America.
No, in Portland, you've legalized all drugs, but the internet's verboten.
Yeah, that was crazy. We decriminalized.
You did that. Oh, yeah. Dude, it's so good that you did that because now we have an experiment. Like, look at the stats out of Portugal. Like,
I know.
You know, if it's not, if like, I really think that might be on to something. Like, you know, we've had safe injection sites here as a controversy, but then Gabor Mate here started curing hardcore drug addicts with ayahuasca. And Dr. Mm-hmm. Gabor Mate is the man when it comes to that stuff. But he was so successful, the Canadian government had to shut him down because it was going to cost, they were going to lose their payouts and their money. Because, you know, politicians mm-hmm. make money when they do initiatives and they need they need the problems here at the downtown east side. They need those problems because they make money off those problems. And if he's going to actually start curing hardcore lifelong crack addicts, which he was, like curing them with ayahuasca, like that, cost politicians then lose personal money and special interest groups lose money, so they shut them down. But like if what happens in Portland proves to be a success, that could really, dominoes could fall, like with the whole world, like a lot of the West might just go along with that too, just like happened with the same-sex union thing. I was my diocese in the Anglican Church that pushed that through at the synod.
Wow.
And as soon as, and like I was there on the ground working with my spiritual director, who was one of the bishops and gay, to make that happen. And Bishop Michael Ingham, who had a lot of support from his tight buddies, Desmond Tutu and Dalai Lama, and that they really like were doing what they could to influence the change in mentality. And of course, the most rich churches who were conservative bailed from the diocese. And then there was the African Anglican bishops calling for the death of our bishops for heresy and promoting, you know, the evils of homosexuality. And they were writing to Rowan, the bishop, Archbishop Rowan in Canterbury, saying, condemn Bishop Michael Ingham, condemn the other bishops in British Columbia. And Rowan in Canterbury was like, yeah, we don't really work that way anymore since that whole Reformation thing.
Then
all the churches did it. And then all the churches in America followed right after. So quickly it made our heads spin. And it was great.
It's baffling, I wasn't really raised in a Christian church at all. So it's just baffling.
I converted at 18.
Oh, yeah.
I was done with Wicca and Druidry.
As an outsider, it's just baffling to see how much all of these people are so terrified of what other people are doing with their junk. Like, between consenting adults, who the hell cares? Who cares what's in their... Like, are you really that worried about it?
I'm barely interested in what your gender is. Barely. I'm very uninterested in what you do, Arnie. With much love, with your junk. I really don't want to know. I don't want to know.
I'm currently wearing pants.
I'm not.
Watch out, that laptop,
I don't want to have a... Wiener scenario.
What was the story I was telling, though, before we got off on this tangent? Oh, yeah, sigil magic.
I was going to say sex tapes, but no, sigil magic. Sorry.
Sigil magic. But yeah, so I taught this class, and it was really well received, and the class was, pretty easy to put together. It's a very, very introductory level class. So, and it's not just for chaos magic, because, one of the things that I normally do with sigils is planetary magic.
Yeah,
which I think is where sigils are the most fun, because there's
really
you could do colored markers and shit.
Oh yeah, colors. I'm GD, so I'm all about bright colors.
Oh yeah, yeah. And the thing is, if you have some Golden Dawn background, I have some solo Golden Dawn stuff, but then you also have planetary magic from other traditions. You've got even more colors to work with.
Yeah.
So when I
throw in a little Waldorf school in there, and it's a party.
Oh man,
and you get a color and you get a color and you get a color. Yeah.
I just got this great package of rainbow taper candles from on the internet.
You just gave me a Rudolf Steiner on. Yeah.
So that class went really well, and I realized that I enjoyed teaching. So the next thing I did was a planetary magic series. And again, everything really deals with sigils. And even when you're doing planetary magic, if you're doing stuff out of Agrippa or the Picatrix, you're going to be using sigils of some sort, even if it's, copying existing sigils out of the Picatrix to, make amulets, or if you're using Agrippa's methods to create new sigils, he's got all these great methods in there. And then even if you get into the fourth book of occult philosophy, which may or may not be by Agrippa, who the hell knows, that has this really crazy method for creating sigils. And as I was working with it and sort of adapting it to planetary magic, I realized that it was what we call a one-way function in cryptology. And then I was sort of holy shit, all of the sigil stuff, these are all one-way functions. So most sigil creation methods are methods of losing information while adding meaning.
Oh, I like that. That's very well said.
Yeah, but it's amazing because you can hold up I have a little tiny sigil of Saturn here that you can't even see.
Oh, it's such a cute little sigil. Yeah.
I can hold this up and to you, you look at it and it reminds you of all the Saturn stuff you know. You're sort of like, oh, Saturn. And you think of the old man with the scythe, and you think about eating babies, and you think about sad stuff and slow stuff and heavy stuff and lead and then lead-based paint. But who knows what the hell Saturn makes you think about, but there's a ton of meaning in this, which at some point might have been a drawing of a scythe or something that ended up losing information, right? So you can't look at it now and be like, oh, that's a scythe. You look at it right now and you say that's the sigil of Saturn. So meaning has increased while information is decreased.
Or more of a sickle, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, all planetary sigils, as we have in a, this is, goes back to, I believe, an original GD lecture for the 2 = 9th Euricus, are based on the cross, crescent, and
circle. Yeah.
Crescent. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. At least the modern ones are. I think if you go back in time, they do get a little wonky and wobbly, and it's kind of hard to really say that. But the way that we all settled on everything, that's definitely what they're based on. But when you make a sigil with chaos magic, or when you make a sigil with like the Kabbalah of 9 chambers or something of that nature, you are basically putting in a word. And as the word goes through the transformation, you lose the ability to reverse the word out of the transformation, right? So that's what makes it a one-way function.
Yes, yes. That's, you know, I mean, it makes perfect sense, of course. It's just, you say it so well. You say it well. You're adding layers of semiosis or semiotic symbolic power.
Yeah.
By removing the details of the meaning in a way. Yeah, it's, you just, like you said it well. So like, yeah, of course, I usually draw my sigils based on, you know, the RC Laman, because that's what
Dawn
Adepts do.
Right, right. But that uses the same, it's the same sort of thing, right? You're still going to lose information.
Oh, of course.
Maybe not as much, because you don't really...
It's hard to reverse engineer them because you don't know what letter they start on. So, so you draw a circle over the petal that it starts on, and then you trace it to the next letter. And if the next letter is really close in the same line, then you have to do a little squiggle, and then you go to the next one and you put a line at the end. But if you don't know where it starts,
it's really
you'd have you couldn't decode it without knowing that's a symbol for Barzabel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then at the same time, so like I was thinking about it. Johannes Trithemius has his steganographia and his polygraphia, which uses two-way functions.
Yes.
Right? Because with the steganographia, you basically have a function that he, you know, lays out for you, like take the first letter of every word or take the first letter of every third word or something like that. So you can encode information.
That can be decoded.
And then it can be decoded later. However, I think that kind of when you encode the information, you lose meaning that way, because you take like an actual sentence and you encode it into like a string of barbarous words that you might not even be able to say anymore. And it might not have the same kind of like cool visual effect, or I don't know. I have to think about that a little bit more. But so what I'm working on now, or what I'm getting ready to release right now, is a class on cryptography and magic.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. It's going to be some math, and it's going to be some concepts and some history and stuff, but then it's going to be like, here are techniques that I'm using. Hey, math is good for you.
I love math.
But yeah, like I've been using the techniques. I've been using techniques to, I mean, some of the stuff that it allows you to do, for instance, is create cryptographic keys using sacred texts, and then encode your like sigils or intent or sacred names or messages to the gods or whatever using like cryptographic keys out of, you know, from sacred texts, which is fun. You know, it's an interesting technique. You can do all sorts of weird combinations with the various things, so I'm still playing around with that, but it's been really fascinating to look at how this stuff can be sort of advanced beyond like the level that Trithemius and then Agrippa got to when they were working with this stuff.
Yeah, I love that you're advancing it. That's great.
And now a word from our sponsors. While we cannot control whether any ads get put in the spots allocated, we thank you for listening to those that do, since they help keep this project alive. You can also get ad-free content and bonus content and videos and a private webpage by subscribing exclusively to magicwithoutfears.com for only a couple dollars a week, or $6 a month, or $50 for the year. It helps a lot, plus you get emails about other exclusive things. Thank you very much.
It's I would probably not count as a heavy sigil magician myself, I think. And you wouldn't consider, would you consider working with the Shem angels and their sigils planetary sigil work, or is that something different in your mind?
I guess it's, yeah, I mean, it's definitely planetary, yeah. Right? Because the...
I like the colors myself. Like, I have a beautiful
set of... Yeah, the colors are great, but
talismans
also
I made. And,
the Shem HaMafarash are all associated with decans, or more than decans, I guess. But yeah, that I would say.
Yeah, degrees.
Less than decans. Yeah. They're small chunks of degrees. Yeah. But yeah, I would definitely consider any sort of magic that uses sigils, which you are if you're doing Golden Dawn style stuff at all.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing. You can't escape sigils. So you can't, it's, you know, but I'm definitely not one of these people who sits around all day drawing sigils. Actually, the main time
say sigil,
I mean,
magic,
which I have nothing against that. I think that's great that people are so into it. It's really beautiful. There is other disciplines within magic though to focus on. That's something.
Right. I don't want to give the impression that, that sigil magic is about creating sigils. You know, it's about using them also.
Well,
And it's sort of a core skill in magic. Like we all use them.
Yeah, it just, you can't, it's inescapable. It really is. It really is.
why did we both get sort of quiet and like introspective? They're like,
because we thought sigils of all the work we have to do.
I know. It's like, oh,
think
God
of all the work we have to do. I mean, like, my favorite way to work with sigils, honestly, the main thing I do with sigils, besides all the mandatory stuff I have to use them for, is I heard that. Cheers, brother. Cheers.
Cheers. It's delicious.
LaCroix. Yep. That's such a Yankee thing. We have some other versions up here. I think we have LaCroix as well, but whatever. The main thing I do is, for me, like the part of sigil work that I enjoy, where I really come to life and feel like get excited, is when I'm working with the spirit, you know, in evocation or astral work, you know, whether through scrying in the spirit vision or traveling in the spirit vision. And when I'm working with the spirit, I get them to create a sigil with me. And sometimes that'll be me drawing in the diary book page where I'm using for transcription with my communications with that spirit. But I get them to direct me. And often sometimes it might even be like, especially if I'm doing an entheogenic working, which can go on for some time, or sober. Either way, they're different. They have different benefits and pluses and minuses, in my opinion. You know, it is very hard to focus sometimes with certain workings. But at the same time, what you see can be much more visual, right? But it can also be more challenging, and that's where you get really like Leech and them are always saying it's sort of shamanic, because you're like, I've got like the incense, I'm like wafting my face, and I'm like dripping balls, and I'm like, I'm saying the invocation over and over for sometimes hours, and then, you know, I connect the being, and it's like, wow, I'll actually see something. Sometimes I'll go in astral and then I'll come out of it astral, and I'll like open my eyes, I'm like, oh, I see something there. That's like, I see a portal of light with light streaming through it sometimes, and there's like this shape there, and that's like, that's, you know, that's 5 grams of mushrooms for you.
Yeah.
it's very hard. It's very exhausting to do it that way, but you do get to have a more physical experience than you might otherwise. Now, of course, those experiences still happen soberly in sober ritual, and sometimes they're a lot more smooth. They take less time. Often they can be a lot easier on the system. But sometimes it's actually a lot easier just, you know, to just ask the question and stuff. But either way, I'll often be drawing that sigil in my diary for quite a while as the spirit gives me different things to do. And then I'll have a really rough shape of a sigil, and then I'll take it from there onto a, like a canvas or a piece of wood or whatever the material is, and then paint it more things. And often if I'm really hardcore about the being I'm working with, I'll reinvoke that being while creating that sigil and do it in the circle. And then I right. have what is quite a powerful talisman for me to then communicate. Like if I look, when I look at one of these sigils that I create, last one I did was for Midir, the king of the fairies, using one of Yeats's evocations that he wrote, right? Which mm-hmm. is super cool, right? Like, yeah, let's use a cool. Yeats evocation, talk to Midir and get a sigil that we, all of us in the Celtic Mysteries could work with to contact this thing or create your own, whatever. And yeah, when you look at that sigil that you've created, it is so easy to communicate with that spirit wherever it exists. And that's to me like the power of this sort of magic. Like,
oh yeah, you're creating, yeah, I totally agree.
You're using whatever's in whatever grimoires are written by other magicians that's written down, you're using it to make that initial contact, but you're always going from there, right? And after that you leave often the source texts that got you there behind for that working for that spirit, because you've got the relationship. And that's where I think a lot of people need to remember magic goes. It's your, like, I've been saying this a lot to people these days who keep referencing authorities to me. I'm sorry, I've talked a while. I'll finish this up and see what you think, because a lot of people have asked me certain questions that have led me to the same answer each time recently, which is, don't worry about what those people are saying. All these competing opinions. There's definitely, I love competing voices in magic. We definitely need to keep that in a hospitable space for competing voices and visions. That's great. But it's your magic. It is your magic. It is no one else's magic. Even the people teaching you, people who write the books that you've read, it's your magic. Like you are the spark of the divine, creating your greater relationship to that divine source and bathing in that communication with your divine self and the divine in nature. Yeah, don't, seriously, the like Dion Fortune said in the one or two years ago, there's just no room for authority in occultism. There really isn't.
Did you just quote an authority?
Well, the irony is not lost on any of us, right? As she makes this authoritarian statement, there's no room for authority.
There is no authority in magic.
There's no room for authority in magic. And I say this as Dion Fortuna.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. You know, and in fact, you see it even in older works, like the Arbitel is very plain about it. It's like there's so little ritual in the Arbitel, and it's basically like, here's the sigil that gets you the initial contact. Here's like the tiniest of paragraphs about what you're contacting, and warning: when you contact them, if you do it right, they'll lead you on your own journey. They're going to give you a secret name. They're going to give you secret signs. Never share them with anybody else. You're now out on your own. So like you see it in a lot of stuff. And I think that, I usually call the sigils that you're describing, I sort of call those received sigils or channel sigils, I guess.
You're good at the names, brother.
Hey, you know, I am
master namer.
I've been speaking English for nigh on
38 years. You're younger than me. You look younger than me.
Oh, thanks.
Welcome to Magic Without Fears Comedy Hour.
Yeah, no, I'm. I just
brought to you
45,
by
actually.
2-for-1 Odrenochrome Sales.
I don't. This is
my imaginary sponsor is 2-for-1 Adrenochrome. 2-for-1 Adrenochrome. It's just a little shout out to my buddies all across the political spectrums. In case you think that you're going to hear anything serious here, no, it's just fun and games. Fun and games.
Oh, no. I think that we totally were talking about serious spirit conjuration, though. That stuff's serious. Like real, real serious.
It's so serious. It's so serious. You don't even know.
Yeah. And meanwhile, I'm being sponsored by LaCroix.
That might actually get us the podcast into more trouble than my joke sponsorship. They'll be like, we did not endorse that. We did not endorse those guys. Trust us.
I mean, when you think about it, LaCroix means the cross, and it's totally a sigil. It's words indicating a sigil on the can, right? So it's probably part of some conspiracy.
Whereas, but could you imagine if, but you know for sure we're not going to get a cease and desist letter from Maria Abramovich saying, I did not endorse them with my 2-for-1 Adrenochrome sale. Use code Epstein.
Oh, God.
I know, I know. I know that if even one person laughs, it was all worth it.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And I know
laughed,
a lot of...
But it was a very nervous and uncomfortable laugh.
Good. Let the record show.
Let the record show.
Yeah.
So are you guys still all locked down up there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's sort of loosened a bit, as my Uber driver was telling me the other night. Ontario is like stay-at-home orders. Quebec is under martial law, like actual. Oh, yeah. Like I might have ended now, but like actual martial law, like police control. And that's
what happened to Free Quebec.
The Bloc Québécois, we are the free people. Like they wouldn't have had to go under complete curfew and martial law if they had all just stopped, like, you know, fucking on Tinder all the time.
Oh yeah.
Like that's probably what's going on. You got all these sexy people out there. Like, well, what, I don't know. It's my ongoing theory that, like, again, I had three middle of the night FaceTime messages, or calls that I didn't answer. And it was some of my pretty actor friends from Vancouver, who I still haven't seen since I've been here. Cause they're like, we can't see anyone. It's gotta be safe. But you know, the next thing you know, these pretty mofos are FaceTiming me at 2-3 AM, want to hang out or whatever. Cause their Tinder date left already. I'm like, you're the problem here. You guys are the problem here. Whatever this is, like, he won't have coffee in the day at a bar where we can legally meet up. But you're like shagging on FaceTime, and they're still all fucking dating, and that's what they're doing. Like,
Victor is a vector.
Yeah, my little sister is going on all these dates every week and stuff. And I asked my other sister, I'm like, well, so is she? You think she's getting close to these people? And she's like, So I don't know. But basically, like my Uber driver was saying, we're not under curfew or martial law because we're being safer. We're doing better. We're doing better than the other provinces. And, you know, so that's good. Like, you know, there's a reason to behave so that you don't get punished. Good old socialism. Socialist.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean,
if we behave, we get to keep having our little freedoms, and that's the deal. That's the social contract of our country.
And they're bribing you guys to behave too, right?
Yeah. Like, everyone gets money.
Like, money. That's great.
Yeah.
It would work. That would work really well here. A lot of people would be like, what, $2,000 a month if I just like stay home and watch reruns of Magnum PI?
Yeah.
Get stoned.
Yeah. It's legal everywhere. So,
not in the entire United States.
Well, no, but, here. That's what I meant.
That's going to be, I feel like it, I would not be surprised if marijuana decriminalization or legalization rolled out nationwide here soon.
I mean, I'm so tempted to make a Kamala Harris joke, but I won't.
Why does... Oh, I mean, you know, she...
Because she jailed so many people for pot.
I know.
And Biden was the one who basically wrote a lot of these laws that he's now pretending to be against. It's just... we don't need to get into that because, like...
Yeah, let's not get into it.
No, everyone knows at this point. Everyone knows that...
It's exhausting and horrible. It's just like, oh, why can't we just... Oh, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's no good solution anymore. We've backed ourselves into like so many corners. We like backed ourselves into a corner and we're like, no, wait, there's another corner that's inside this corner. It's a little insane. Let's go there. And so that's where we are now.
I mean, it is the final nail in the coffin of the global illusion of American exceptionalism, really. This idea that America and Americans have always been just a skosh better than the rest of us. Like, you know, right now the whole world, even if most of us were like, yeah, they are sort of better. Now we're like, nah, like, those people are fucked, y'all. They're so fucked. They're super fucked.
Like, it was,
as my friends in England say, that you're eating yourselves alive. And it's heartbreaking too, because one, it means I can't be there and we can't all just live our lives and stuff like that, and two, I have friends who are being extremely hurt by this in the States. Like, I have friends who are being so hurt by this I can't even talk to them anymore. and I don't even know if they have a home. And so it's like, oh my God, like I know they lost a job a while back. I knew that things were coming for them. Like, you know, and now it's like, now they're just AWOL. And it's like, I'm worried.
I am too. It's I have friends who are in the same position, and it's like, we're losing so many small businesses. And nobody has a safety net because, you know, the other thing we've like all of our prices, like housing and food and insurance and like everything has just been skyrocketing for decades. So we're in a pretty bad spot. I would say American exceptionalism ended a long time ago. Everybody was just in denial about it.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I want to go on record that I like, since, you know, everyone's listening, that I still think Americans are the best, and that whoever's in power and control, especially this podcast, they're the best. Everyone's the best. You're all the best. And I'm towing the party line. I'm totally towing the party line, brought to you by 2 for 1.
Oh God. Okay. Let's not talk about politics anymore.
But I actually have a way to bring it back to wizardry.
Okay.
What is our responsibility if we're just like little Yod-Heh Vav-Heh's or little Gandalf's running around this sphere of the Nuos? What's our responsibility in this besides just putting out expensive books people get mad they can't afford, or teaching classes that they get mad they can't afford, or doing free stuff that they get mad that they could afford, but they're too lazy to show up?
Oh man.
Besides from all that, you don't actually get to pick any of those options. What is our responsibility? Do all of them. Is there responsibility as magicians to how we can help things out? Like I'm a much more a Enochian person than mm-hmm. than grimoire person. If that makes sense. And so
that makes sense.
One of the things that stood out for me is the opportunity given with the Enochian system to directly impact parts of the planet. And without being too in breach of to be silent, let's just say I'm sort of focused on, for lack of a better word, China's concentration camps. I feel that if there's angelic or spirit workings that I can do to maybe help that I feel is a noble thing for me to communicate with those angels about, even if all they can do is maybe make any of the people, the Muslim Chinese Uyghurs in those places,
right,
find anything, like, you know, have a longer bathroom break before they get tased, because that's a thing, right? Like, you know, I feel the Enochian system does allow an avenue for effective, I don't want to say it's effective change, but magic. I mean, in some ways, mm-hmm. the work is the purpose of the work is the work, as it does work on our souls theurgically as well as in the world in wonders mm-hmm. thaumaturgically. But yeah, what do you see as a place that
I've
magicians...
actually, this is something I've thought about a lot, actually.
Awesome.
I think that there are a few avenues that are important. First, I think that practitioners have a responsibility to be more involved in their community. And this is something that, you know, at least my impression of magic over the years has been a lot of times people who get involved in the occult tend to be sort of, you know, a little antisocial or outcasty, or kind of like on the fringes of society and not sort of like more involved, more present. But if you look at like the roles that like cunning folk played, or that healers played, or that shamans and diviners played in the old days, it's obvious that we had, you know, a role. You know, we had things that we were supposed to be doing for our community. At the same time, I think that we can see from a lot of older grimoires that a lot of magic was also sort of geared around like teaching us practical skills. So I think that learning important practical skills that can help in your community, especially in like disaster preparedness or just sort of like around, you know, your local area. I think learning that sort of stuff and getting involved in that sort of stuff is really important for practitioners. You know, we're basically like amateur priests, and so we should be available when people need us.
I like that.
And then another thing that I think is really important is, and this is something that we see not only in grimoires, but in a lot of lodge-based magic practice, is we're supposed to be working on being better people. And we can see this in a lot of places. Like, for instance, at the end of book one of the Corpus Hermeticum, in the Hermetic prayer that's there, one of the things that Hermes promises God is that he's like, I will go forth and help enlighten those who are in darkness, right? So he's basically saying, like, I will bring knowledge to people. I won't hide this. I will help enlighten the world. But you also see these prescriptions or commands all over the place to do things like eliminate the tormentors of your vice, like get rid of vices, embrace virtuous acts and do virtuous things, and embrace all of this good that we can do. Because when you are good, part of being good involves like interacting with the world. You know, you can't be good if you're just holed up in your own little house all the time. You have to be interacting with others in order to do good. So I think that those are kind of two things. We have to work on being better individuals, like better in terms of like virtue. And then I think we also need to be cultivating skills that make us useful to our communities. Whether those are magical or more practical or some combination of the two, I don't have a good answer for that. But I do think that we should be here as support. We're like the support folks. Like, yes, we are working on theurgy, but one of the big things about theurgy, you know, like in Kabbalah, we're all part of the Yehida. You know, we have to head towards that great oneness. Mm-hmm. And that means like everybody around you should be heading there too.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, it's the origin of the word liturgy. Did you know that? Liturgy Mm-mm. comes from liturgia to theou, which is, so it literally means liturgy, a public work for the common good. That's the origin of the word liturgy. It shouldn't be locked up behind doors or in inner sanctum sanctorums. It mm-hmm. should be available, some form of it should be available for the common good. At Temple Tehuti, we used to go around the downtown east side where it was based and give out fruit to homeless people and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We were eventually ordered to stop because we could be poisoning it or putting razor blades. It was, you know, they found a way to stop that, as they often do. They.
Oh, yeah, because all of you scary Satanists with your scary Satan fruits.
So far from Satanism, I know it's so crazy that people still even today people still make that equation, and it's pretty funny because it's like, yo, we sort of dig Jesus. We changed the Jewish tetragrammaton so it looks more like Jesus.
Yeah, like, we just since stuck Mirandola. That sheen right in the middle. You know, my hermetic.
We're like, it was there all along. You just couldn't see it. That's the story.
The invisible fire.
The invisible fire was the shin, and now we're just like,
yeah. My hermetic lodge, which can't meet in person, so we've been doing all of our stuff remotely. Like we all did this is something that we started doing last year, is the Coptic Handbook of Ritual Power for Epiphany.
Oh, cool.
And it's a great ritual. Like it is just like the Mall of America of barbarous names. Every barbarous name you want is in there. It's just, it's amazing. And it's long, it's pretty long. It's when you print it out, it's only 4 pages long, but so much stuff is like, repeat this 7 times. And you're like, the whole paragraph, okay. So, you know, it takes like an hour and a half to get through when you're doing it on your own. But the thing that like really threw me off the first time we did it is there's a lot of Jesus in it. Like you'll be just plugging along, going through these barbarous names, and it'll stop to like, in the name of Jesus Christ. And I'm like,
yeah.
So, you know, like there's a lot of Jesus in magic. I don't think the Satan fearing people really realize that. I mean, sure, yeah. Like in the Coptic Handbook of Ritual Power, you're invoking Jesus like alongside all these pagan gods too. But that's what everybody did back then. You just sort of borrowed. You're like, hey, y'all have a god of like rabbits that I can put along with my stew god, and we could like chant the names together and maybe get some rabbit stew out of this magic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that would be something Dr. Justin Sledge, who's a rabbi, could comment on a lot, of course. Mm-hmm. And when I was in seminary, they made it very clear that ancient Israelite religion is centered around Yahweh as it was. We know from graffiti that there was a Mrs. Yahweh, because there's explicit graffiti of Yahweh doing things to Mrs. Yahweh. It basically says so. And so you know, but that would Asherah, and then we had to get rid of the goddess, of course, because patriarchalism. But
it's because everybody's just so obsessed with what other people have in their pants.
Gender. Though I loved that lecture at Crowley Mass by the Thelemite, who went back to all of Crowley's stuff and was like, look, this gender thing is silly in the OTO, because Crowley was very clear about seeing himself and all of us as the androgyne, mm-hmm. right? And even I don't know if I've told you this, but I've said it many times, even in seminary, they told us that one of the first popular churches of Jesus in the first and second century that was quickly wiped out was the Church of the Hermaphroditical Jesus. And they had statues of Jesus with both genitalia. This was a very common thing in the early Christianity.
Oh my God. We talked about this
probably,
last time.
We probably did. Yeah. I talked about Jesus the Hermaphrodite a lot because I think it's awesome and hilarious. It's right there along with the triphallus Hermes and the Hermes that has like three penises coming out of his face. I love that version of Hermes. Super kinky.
And you know about, so William Blake was part of the Moravian Church at the end of the 18th century. And the Moravian Church apparently had these crazy visualization techniques, or at least William Blake had these visualization techniques that were like Jesus sexual, where the wound in Jesus's side was like visualized as a vagina and like all of this weird, strange stuff. Margaret Keith Schuchard, is that her name? Margaret Schuchard, I believe, has a book on this called Why Mrs. Blake Cried, and it is a trip. Wow. You really should look it up. It's amazing reading, and you'll be reading it and you'll be like, what the fuck, this is crazy stuff.
Awesome.
It's nuts.
I'm a big Blake fan. I love that book. Fearful Symmetry, of course, is a classic.
Oh yeah,
yeah. That's Northrop Frye, I think, or is it Bloom? It's Bloom, right?
No, that's Carl Bloom? Tiger. That's a poem.
Well, no.
You're talking about a book.
The book Fearful Symmetry. I believe it's either Northrop Frye or Harold Bloom who wrote Fearful Symmetry. Northrop Frye definitely wrote The Great Code, which demonstrates literally the influence of the Bible on all of Western literature for 2,000 years. So if you haven't read The Great Code by Northrop Frye, it's actually not too big, but it's essential.
Oh, I haven't. I'll look that up.
It's a mainstay at secondhand bookstores. I'm sure you'll dig one up at Powell's easily.
Oh, you know about our famous bookstore.
Yeah, people keep going to it and not taking me with them. What's up with that?
Well, if we're ever allowed to have an open border with Canada again, and you can come down to the United States, and we won't give each other the plague.
Yeah. I hope that happens. I mean, our growers here have a lot of backlog of bags of supply that to export to Washington.
You mean marijuana?
Yeah, the growers here. So since the government took control of the marijuana business here, of course, they looked at the 300 shops in Vancouver that were already open, just paying fines and contending with their borderline legality. And they looked at those people who had been doing this so long, for decades and decades, and were basically the reason that the laws passed. They looked at them and they said, well, we could hire these folks who know how the business works to make it work legally, or we could try and reinvent the wheel ourselves. And that's, of course, what they did. And as a result, they shut down all of those stores. Like, over 50 of my friends lost their jobs. And then they opened just one or two stores run by like rich pub owners, or like Donnelly Group, or these other big conglomerate organizations who, you know, jacked up the prices. But as a result, the growers, and we know, everyone in BC knows a lot of growers, like, they're backlogged because they're not selling it fast enough. So it recreated the street market for weed, and it dropped the price. So like, you could go to one of the two shops that are nearby you and spend $14 for a gram, or you could now call up just a street dealer and get an ounce for $20 of like some good stuff, like for $20. I mean, that's so crazy that they did that, and they recreated the black market, I guess it is. It's just the street market of getting weed, and people have gone back to buying weed from their dealers than the 200 stores we used to have in town up until legalization. In fact, we had vending machines. During that period, right before legalization, we had vending machines. You just go up to a vending machine, put in $40, get a half ounce, you're on your merry way in a minute. That was brilliant. But the government was like, no, that's way too effective at distributing this huge product we've now taxed. We need to sell it really slowly so we get as little tax money as I feel like they're afraid of getting too much tax money from it, because then they'd have to put it into education or improving our healthcare system.
Here in Oregon, it just went nuts. Like,
what happened?
Oregon is a really great place to grow marijuana. So basically, there are tons of growers.
I heard a rumor.
Yeah, it's there's a rumor. There are just tons and tons of growers here. And so like the first year, maybe the second year after legalization, there was just this glut of pot on the market. There was so much marijuana on the market. And I don't remember what the prices were, but it was really something. Like, from the legal shops, you could get like an ounce for $20. And they'd have these big signs out, ounce $20 marijuana. And like, you go in and they're basically like selling these huge super fat joints for like a buck each, and so many friggin' candies and gummies, and so many like weird vape pens of marijuana, and in so many varieties. It's just insane.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, every single marijuana has like its own backstory and its own like superhero name and its own like, oh, this one is good if you're trying to read Shakespeare while taking a nap at 2:30 in the afternoon. But this one goes really good with orange juice and scrambled eggs, but not fried eggs. Then you want this one over here. But it's like every single one got has its own rules.
Dude, sometimes I've gone to places and they're like, oh, we have an excellent selection. And they'll show us like this row of jars. And I'm like, where's the rest? Because like, you know, some places like maybe Portland, definitely Vancouver, the way it was like rows upon rows upon rows, like hundreds of stones. You're like, whoa. And they have that kind of pinpoint accuracy because you trust the stoners behind the counter. And I loved it because I would go in, my friends would be working there, but you could just go into the store, buy a joint for $5, a big one, pull it, they give it to you, you light it, take a puff, and then just hand it to them, and then you both smoke it at the counter, and then you repeat.
We can't smoke in the stores here. But usually when I buy marijuana, anymore, I just not go since in and it's I'm been like, legalized. I will have the green one.
Do you have any marijuana that has pot in it?
I heard there's pot-free marijuana.
but
it's great. So another thing that's nuts is like CBD is entirely legal down here across the country. And I don't know how that happened. I don't know I haven't looked to see like what sort of law changed. But now like there are all these podcasts that are advertising CBD things. Like,
see, those are the advertisers I should get on my show. Like, let me read some CBD ads.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll end my sponsorship with Adrenochrome and Abramovich.
Yeah, it's like 2-for-1 Adrenochrome CBD injectables.
Now I'm never going to get advertisers. I mean, I do thank people for listening to the automated ads that get put in this podcast. I really do thank you guys for putting up with
them. Do you have automated ads that are
put in, and I'm really lucky to be on a platform that lets me do that now, because I had troubles before, and I've had troubles. Every platform I go on, I have troubles with. I ran an ad for my David Himesmith podcast through Instagram and Facebook, and they took my money in my account and then terminated my business access to the Instagram and Facebook. They're God, like, I tried they're to like, approved. Here's take the money. Canceled. I was like, it's David Hymesmith. You're gonna cancel David Hymesmith? He's like super. He's yeah, and he's like, he's yeah. not. He's not the kind. He's like not the guy you would see that happening. But I'm sure it was just Pete. It was probably just mob playing in general. It doesn't matter why, because that's
yeah. I don't know. Anyway. I mean, all of the. I tried to promote an episode on Facebook or Instagram, like last year sometime, and they like approved it. They never ended up taking any of my money, but they stuck the ad in some kind of like weird limbo, and I can't get it approved and I can't delete it. And they send me an email like once a month. Here's how your ad is doing. Zero clicks, zero impressions. I'm like, no shit. I don't really care about that ad anymore.
I mean, the truth is, I think I heard a rumor that, you know, Zuckerberg and Facebook and all these corporations, I heard that they're going through a challenging time, let's say.
I've heard, I think I saw something about that on the news.
Yeah, something about that, like, you know, testimonies, lies, mass surveillance. Well, the big deal is Twitter's being sued in British Columbia, just down the street from me. Like, I'm going to go there and cover it, actually. Like,
why
so
they are they getting sued? What did Twitter do to British Columbia?
Now I go, yeah, right? Oh, no, no. The reason they're being sued in British Columbia is because the guy who had these defamatory tweets made about him, and I shouldn't even say his name. I'll say he's associated with the Clinton Foundation, and there's a lot of pizza emojis associated with him and stuff like that. But let's just, I don't want to get too, but like everyone knows, but like, so he wanted, So the lawsuit, they tried to move it to California and had nothing to do with California because he's based here. He's got offices here in British Columbia for the Clinton Foundation. And there's a bunch of other stuff that I've talked about before, so I don't need to talk about it again, but it's like some crazy stuff, of course. But he's trying to have the lawsuit moved. Twitter's trying to have the lawsuit moved because, and the Supreme Court of British Columbia said no. They said no. This is not a valid reason to move the lawsuit. And they could, which is a huge precedent, which means Twitter might have to reform entirely because they could lose billions of dollars in this lawsuit. And the reason they want it moved out of British Columbia is because we don't have Section 230. You don't have any.
Section 230.
That's the US laws that protect Twitter and Facebook and all these companies by saying that, you know, my private platform. And we're not responsible for what comes out, even though we edit everything we don't like. You know, right? They do, because they don't deserve these protections because they do choose who gets through and who doesn't.
They do,
and therefore they should be therefore responsible for what is said, or just go back to it being a town square. That's how it should be. But the problem is that whole debate, that whole issue doesn't exist at all in Canada because we don't got free speech, motherfuckers. Up here, it's like, up here, if you say something, we take you before a human rights tribunal. Oh, were you a comedian on stage making a joke? Too bad. Someone got offended. $30,000. That's why our comedians are like Ryan Long are all moving to the United States because they're like, we can't even perform anymore. And Canada's like, that's right. Hey.
That's weird. There was.
It is super weird, bro.
That's weird. Well, I'm sorry that exists. Every right has its ups and its downs, and we deal with that all the time down here.
All the time.
We can't really. It's hard to. It's hard to pull my brain away from like the American view on how rights are supposed to work and try to understand how it's supposed to go in other countries.
It's so nice being back in Canada, man. It's so nice to be back in Canada. It took me a few months to stop talking about all the stuff going on down there. But eventually my family was like, look, you can say one thing about it once a day. and now there's days that go by where I don't say anything. I'm like, that's healthier for me. I'm focusing more on, you know, reading grimoires. This came in the mail today.
What'd you get? Oh yeah, I've got
Ash and Chassan's Gateways Through Lightning. I mean, I've looked through copies my friends have had before. My buddy Jesse has one of the $1,000,000,000,000 versions and limited and stuff. But yeah, it's actually a beautiful book. It's a beautiful book with beautiful illustrations. And you know, it's something. It reminds me of what we were talking about before with colors. I was like, you know, if I do a book of this quality, the only difference I want to do is I want this instead of being like pencil art, which is well done. Again, everyone clearly needs to own this book by Ash and Chassan. It's just a fact. But I would have it do more like Rudolf Steiner with like aura colors and the watercolors, oh, yeah, the aura light. I want the colors. I want to see those colors because I've never scried anything and seen black and white.
Me neither. Me neither. Yeah. Sometimes I've scried stuff in a crystal and seen it as mostly the color of the crystal, though.
I love how our conversation naturally can very hermetically leap and transgress from one area to another, because now we're back to crystals.
It's like we're going from, up and down, yeah, the spheres.
We fall back into yeah. It's how hermeticists should flow. We narrowly avoid we wings on our feet. We narrowly avoided discussion of Pizzagate. Now we're talking about drawing spirits into crystals. So share your wisdom with my audience on that, because I know it's a huge topic that people would love to hear your take on.
Be as specific as possible. Okay. Well, so, I mean, everybody's familiar with the Trithemian drawing spirits into crystals first.
Published. I think everyone's heard that set.
I will give a little bit of background about it, especially since I was just talking to a scholar about this the other day. So Francis Barrett published this this book called The Magus in 1801. And that book, I'm not going to talk about that too much, except that one of the things in this book was this document called Drawing Spirits into Crystals, which was purported to be by Johannes Trithemius, whom I was talking about an hour ago, and we were talking about one and two-way functions and stuff.
And he was Agrippa's teacher, for those who
He was this...
And an abbot.
He was an abbot near Cologne in Deutschland.
Deutschland. Yeah. Shout out, mein Brüder. I got a lot of German listeners, like a lot. Yeah? They write to me in German. Oh, yeah, they write... On Instagram now, we just talk in German. It's great.
Oh, das ist gut.
Yeah. I abuse them with my strange Viennese dialect.
Es ist eine schöne Sprache.
Es ist eine urschöne Sprache. Super geil.
Und
ich spreche es wie ein guter Wiener Burschel.
Back to Trithemius. So he outlines this whole method along with like some pretty specifically designed tools, like a weird little thing to hold a crystal. There's a wand, there's magic circles, there's specific prayers. You know, it's a short text, but it's a whole system. And it's been used a lot by people over the last 20 years in particular, I think. And it's a way of scrying spirits. And I like it a lot, but I also, being the sort of like, hack magician that I am, I'm like, well, I'm taking out the Jesus stuff out of the prayer. Oh, I don't want to make that weird little stand for the crystal because I got this giant crystal ball, so I'm just gonna use this. Or sometimes I'm like, oh, I'm just gonna use a bowl of water.
I'm a water scryer primarily. I pounded out a Nostradamus bowl out of copper when I was a teenager. My teacher's like, what are you doing in woodshop? I'm like, shh.
Yeah, I use a sterling silver bowl.
Oh gosh, I'll trade you. You can have the one I hammered out of copper.
It's not very 30 big. Years it's ago. Little. It's like this big, but it's perfect for like hovering over, and you can see candles reflecting in it and all that kind of stuff. But that particular method can be used for, it can be adapted for pretty much any sort of grimoire work, right? Like any sort of spirit and grimoire thing. It's easier because you don't need as much of a magic circle set up. You can put the magic circle on like a piece of paper. You know, there's a lot of stuff that just, it simplifies things. And we don't have any proof that it was actually written by Trithemius. It's possible that Francis Barrett had access to a manuscript that is lost, because it turns out Francis Barrett, you know, was a student of Edward Sibley, who was a famous late 18th century astrologer and et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, like I use that pretty often, and I use, you know, variations on drawing spirits into crystals for all sorts of stuff. So, for instance, I'm in this other group that's working through a recently published medieval manuscript, or late Renaissance manuscript, probably, about conjuring the planetary intelligences. And it's not a totally complete system, but it's close. So we basically took it and we're like, oh, we just plug this into drawing spirits into crystals and we're done. And the guy who's leading the group is a really accomplished astrological magician. So he's electing times for us to do the spirit conjurations. And this is just like, astrologically speaking, we're still in sort of the shit show part of the century. So it's tough to find really good elections.
Yeah. So we have using sidereal, not tropical, I imagine, right?
Yeah. Wait, no, we use tropical. Which one is the one that uses the sun? I'm confused now. Well, I've forgotten.
Sidereal is where the constellations and stars are actually at now, and tropical is where they were at when astrology was codified.
Oh, right. We use sidereal.
But it's just a 21 degree difference, I believe, if I recall my mother's words correctly. So it's very easy. Just pull it, count it back or whatever.
Yeah.
Using it's the simple. Ephemeris.
So I missed the first conjuration, but some of the people in the group sort of like wrote up their experiences, and it sounds pretty cool. For some of them, it was their first experience working with drawing spirits into crystals.
Intelligences are interesting. I do have a lot of experience with the intelligences.
I only really have experiences with them when it comes to like using their sigils and names, but I've never conjured them or scryed them. Primarily because there's not a lot of info out there about them. You know, Agrippa writes about them, but outside of Agrippa, he just kind of mentions them as sort of like counterparts to what he calls the spirits of the planets. So there's so much stuff to work with that I just never really got around to intelligences. I was just sort of like, well, I'll write the name on this talisman. That sounds cool, but.
You can only work with so many things. I mean, that's the beauty of this beautiful smorgasbord of Western occultism, is that it's just like literally pick what you want to do in your lifetime, because you can't do it all.
Got to remember, people were mostly making this stuff up at some point. So you can even make up your own.
Well, that's where you get into like, you know, that's where chaos magic has come back to remind us of the manufactured nature of reality in the first place. I mean, you even see that with neo-paganism and all this stuff just getting created from people's experiences, or armchair manufactured out of thin air, and then someone does it and it sort of seems to work for them, and next thing you know, you have a whole tradition.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy how that works.
It's almost like reality is sort of somewhat consensual.
Or maybe reality is a lie.
What's wrong with my legs? You've never used them before.
There is no spoon.
There's no spoon, baby. I mean,
but
there also is a spoon, and because we've said there is, and so that's also sort of how this stuff works. I mean,
it's true.
Be wary of thinking it's all in your head.
Yeah.
I was talking about this last night with Frater C and stuff, and I said, you know, some of my earlier stuff where if you listen to me online, it sounds almost like I do come from a psychological model. I'll say things like, you know, it might even sound like some people have said that I don't even believe really in magic. And I'm like, well, or maybe I was sort of towing part of a party line, you know?
Like, yeah, and
maybe, because I don't think actually any of the people with the psychological model actually believe in the psychological model. I think they're just saying that to lower people's expectations and not freak them out. And that way you can go at it in earnest. And then when you have a non-psychological experience, if there is such a thing, you'll be like, oh snap, crazy.
Yeah,
but if you're going for that as the result all the time, you're gonna get discouraged.
I don't know that you need to, that I would have necessarily interpreted the stuff you're saying as being part of the psychological model.
Oh no, that would be me years ago when I first started talking, because I was still or entertaining some hope of going back to work in the church or the university system. And I've now fully given up on that. Like, because while magicians may be amateur priests, like I certainly am not an amateur priest. I went through seminary. I worked for the church. I was there at the St. Augustine's giving sermons every Sunday. Right.
That's true.
I am a priest, and I take that stuff very seriously. It's very real for me, but you know, a couple hundred grand in 7 years of seminary will do that to you. But I take my magic just as seriously, and I think we need to really not worry so much about how we conceptualize things and focus more on the experiences.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good way to look at it. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess I was just also sort of thinking about how even in some of like the real, you know, like we have in the Hermetica, we have all this stuff about how, you know, sensation is a lie. So that idea is old, you know, the idea of reality not being the real reality, you know, it goes back to Plato's cave.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you really, really want to get out of the psychological realm and have some visual physiological experiences, that's where entheogens play a beautiful role in the spiritual systems that we know and love.
And a lot of them are decriminalized in Oregon. So there you go. Come on down.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not all up here, sadly, yet. But like, we've never illegalized peyote or 5-MeO-DMT. That's completely legal in Canada. People don't realize it. A lot of people I know with a 5-MeO or doing 5-MeO-DMT, or you know, same as from the gland of the Sonora Desert Toad, the bufo. A lot of them are very hush hush. But I'm like, you know, it's legal. And they're like, what? Yeah, it's like totally legal. They're like, DMT's legal. I'm like, no. 5-MeO-DMT is legal, which is why I say whenever I'm talking about DMT, I obviously mean 5-MeO.
Right, right. Yeah. Me too.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Just like when I talk about mushrooms, I actually mean marijuana.
Yeah, I don't have to worry about that. I'm pretty sure if I talk about mushrooms, I'm talking about mushrooms.
Well, it's legal for you guys now, so we'll get there. We'll all get there. The world is doing a few good things, so amen.
Slowly inching towards it. Well, you know, I think that it's about time for me to get going. My voice is starting to get a little
Yeah, you need to go have your daily joint.
Yeah, or something.
So I'm joking. I mean, it's been great talking to you. I'm really glad we got to reconnect and stuff. Tell people about how they can find your upcoming courses and stuff like that.
Okay. Well, almost everything goes through my website, arnemancy.com, which is arnemancy.com. I've got my courses are on there. My podcast is on there. My blog, which I don't write in as often as I should. And, you know, I sell books, but they're reasonably priced. And I sell my courses, which I think are reasonably priced. They're not like, sometimes I do free stuff, but you know, I live in the United States and the government isn't sending me money all the time. So I still need to like pay rent and shit.
Hey, I'm not getting the government money, just to be clear. I'm not. I should, and I don't know why. I'll have to do some ritual work on that. But no, they don't make it. They don't necessarily make it that easy, but yeah, so you have a full-on website that people can find you at. And I think most occult stuff is massively underpriced. Massively underpriced.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I wish that I had more money to spend on other people's occult stuff, but I try to, you know, yeah. I also try to like spread it around. And I'm on Patreon. But so just arnemancy.com. And then I'm arnemancy on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's how we got in touch is the beautiful good old Instagram. Yeah. I mean, people can find me there, fratter.rc or esoteric ebooks.
Yeah.
We're out there doing our thing, right? Like that's what's great. We're still just doing our thing. I think one of the reasons we price ourselves low these days, especially, is because there is an occult revolution happening, and what we do want, some of us serious people, is try to encourage people and shepherd them into a deeper approach and appreciation and understanding. And once they're there, we have more people to work with, and it's good for the community overall. And that's perhaps one of the greatest things you and I can foster as participants in this occult revolution that, you know, will not be televised.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean,
as we speak into cameras.
Right. One of the things that I really loved about teaching the Intro to Sigils class is like so many people would show up and be like, I've never done any of this stuff before. And then I tell them and they're like, this is it. That's how you do it. I'm like, that's how you do it. And then they go and do it and they start emailing me all these, like, I made this sigil for blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, yes, I've made some magicians. I made magicians.
Bro, you made magicians. Oh,
like
my God.
Like with PowerPoint slides, I used PowerPoint slides to make magicians.
PowerPoint, brother, that's like next level up. I just like hold up sketches I drew on toilet paper. I'm like, see, I drew that.
We can't talk about toilet paper in the United States. It's very politicized.
Oh, yeah. No. Damn.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having
Shalom,
me.
Shalom, brother. And people can see the video of this on my free Cyber Guild, hermeticmysteryschool.com. The video will be there. Yeah.
Cool. I'm glad I did my mustache today.
Your mustache looks amazing.
Wait, was that facetious?
No.
Good. I'm treating it literally.
No, it looks amazing. I'm a fan of mustaches. We all do our own thing.
Yeah. That was a callback. You know, I was making a joke.
I got it. The beginning. You're tying it all together like Chappelle.
Yeah. You know, time is a closed circle or something.
The serpent's got to swallow its tail. Otherwise, it's just another snake.
Exactly.
All right. Peace profound, brother. Shalom.
Shalom.
Hermetic Science Enterprises is a publishing company based in Scotland, UK, that specializes in Western esoteric printed literature as well as educational videos. With various imprints under its belt, its roster consists of grimoire tradition literature, alchemical works, Golden Dawn tradition books, and the several texts and videos originally belonging to the philosophers of nature. Besides its downloadable videos and standard hardcover edition books, Hermetic Science Enterprises also produces beautiful and precious limited fine edition books that are true pieces of art. For more information to order any of its products, please visit www.hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. That's hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. And as a lot of you know, I've talked with the publisher Lenny on the podcast before, including a 6-hour epic extended version on the Patreon, and seen the fine edition of his new grimoire of Scott's Discovery of Witchcraft, which is only available for purchase up to 50 limited copies till the end of May, I believe. So check it out now. HermeticScienceEnterprises.co.uk.